Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Hudson Institute's first conference this calendar year on the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. My name is Seth Cropsey. I'm a senior fellow here at Hudson and director of Hudson Center for American Sea Power. Many of you will have noticed by now that the U.S. has a new president. And that then President-elect Trump and Taiwan's democratically elected president, Tsai Ing-wen, spoke by phone in December. That phone call is not the subject of this conference. Rather, the future of the U.S.-Taiwan security relationship is our topic today. But I think of the call as a symbol of what I expect will be a strengthening of the United States' support for Taiwan's security and thus its free people and its democratic institutions. And I think of this support not only as honoring a commitment that began in the first half of the 20th century, but also as a symbol of the alliance system on which this nation's security, the United States' security, and the future of democratic states around the world rest. Affirming the U.S.-Taiwan security relationship is a powerful and unmistakable sign that the United States remains a reliable partner and ally, from East Asia to the Middle East to Africa, Europe, and in our own hemisphere as well. As the world's great power, the U.S. has an unusual responsibility to act and to be seen as a dependable partner. Lately, politicians have squabbled in this country over slogans like America First. This is like arguing whether a hole in the roof must be repaired. There is no doubt that the leaders of democratic states must put the interests of their people first. There is also no doubt that this often means cooperation with other states whose geography, political institutions, and diplomacy form a common bond whose strength secures shared interests. The United States' cooperation and partnership with Taiwan fits all these elements of a common bond. Taiwan's geography places it in the middle of the first island chain that brackets the mainland. In fact, Taiwan sits at the center of U.S. alliances in East Asia. Strategically, control of the first island chain is essential for conventional deterrence in Asia. Taiwan's political institutions are a daily reminder that democracy is as much at home in East Asia as it is in America, a lesson that applies far beyond Taiwan's coast. Our diplomatic interests converge along the same democratic lines. Putting America first requires us to consider our economic relationship with Taiwan, for example, our ninth largest trading partner and an integral part of our commercial relations with other democratic states in the region. Requires us to think of Taiwan's interest in defending itself in the face of the PRC's ongoing threat to resolve cross-strait issues by force, and our interest in the region's peace, as well as in deterring the harm that would accompany China's projection of power into the Central Pacific. Putting America first means honoring our commitments to Taiwan. And with us today to discuss this topic in greater detail, we are honored to have, in order of their presentations, Dennis Wilder, Ian Easton, and Bill Schneider, all experts in the U.S.-Taiwan relations with a particular emphasis on security. Professor Wilder will look at the history of the U.S.-Taiwan security relationship and offer an update on the administration's record thus far. Ian Easton will look at the current state of Taiwan's defenses and the PRC's military, as well as provide an analysis, an explanation at least, a look at the current U.S. administration's defense budget for Taiwan. Finally, Hudson's own senior fellow Bill Schneider will examine what U.S. policy ought to be toward Taiwan and what steps are needed more faithfully to carry out the provisions of existing commitments to Taiwan's defense. I would like to sit down here and let our speakers begin their presentation, so I will not read to you what you can read for yourself on the programs that you have there about their distinguished experience and why they are, in fact, here on this stage. So with that, let me turn the podium over, or if you wish to speak from your seat, to Professor Wilder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Seth, for inviting me to speak today and joining this distinguished panel. And thank you to the Hudson Institute for hosting. I guess because I am a newly minted academic, I am going to define the terms of this discussion. So let me start out by looking at what Secretary Tillerson said in the confirmation process. Because when he was asked by Senator Cardin to answer a question, a written answer, he gave a very comprehensive response that should be, I think, the guiding principles as far as what the administration is going to do for going forward. And he said that the people of Taiwan are friends of the United States, should not be treated as a bargaining chip. The U.S. commitment to Taiwan is both a legal commitment and a moral imperative. He then went on to say that, of course, the U.S. One China policy recognizes the PRC as the sole legal government of China and acknowledges China's position that Taiwan is part of China. But for our purposes today, what he said next is most important, which is, as required by the TRA, the U.S. continues to provide Taiwan with defensive arms and maintains the capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or the social or economic system of the people of Taiwan. He also said the U.S. upholds the six assurances. The key, of course, in his statement for our purposes today is the reaffirmation of the Taiwan Relations Act and the six assurances, which during my time in government have been the bedrock of our policy toward Taiwan on the security side. To remind you, and most of you know this, but there may be some in the audience who haven't studied the history quite as closely, the TRA was adopted by Congress and enacted on 10 April 1979 after the Carter administration abrogated the Mutual Defense Treaty with the Republic of China. You may not recall, but Senator Goldwater actually took the Carter administration to court over that abrogation of the treaty, saying that the administration did not have the right to abrogate a treaty on its own. However, the United States Supreme Court said this was a political, not a judicial matter, and refused to rule on the issue. And thus, the Congress felt strongly and rightly that it needed to weigh in on exactly what our commitments to Taiwan would be after normalization with Beijing. And the key points here, I will not read the Taiwan Relations Act to you. You can go and find that for yourself. But the key points are that the policy of the United States is to provide arms of a defensive nature to maintain Taiwan's self-defense capability and to maintain the capacity of the United States to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion against Taiwan. Later on, when the United States in 1982 was negotiating the third communique, which obviously was going to have elements in it of trying to reduce arms sales to Taiwan. The Taiwan government came to the Reagan administration and suggested 6 points of reassurance that the United States could make to Taiwan as it negotiated that communique. And these 6 points, again, you can read them for yourselves, but I just want to briefly remind you of them because they have been central to the policy of the United States on Taiwan. Number one, U.S. would not set a date for termination of arms sales to Taiwan. Number two, the United States would not alter the Taiwan Relations Act. Number three, the U.S. would not consult with China in advance of making decisions about Taiwan arms sales. Number four, the U.S. would not mediate between Taiwan and China. Fifth, the U.S. would not allow its position about Taiwan sovereignty, which was that the question was to be decided peacefully by the Chinese themselves and would not pressure Taiwan into negotiations. And finally, the U.S. would not formally recognize Chinese sovereignty over Taiwan. Now, some may debate whether we have lived up to all of those commitments, but I can tell you from my years in government, from my years in the Bush administration in particular, I feel that I always abided by these agreements and these assurances, and that I was very aware and conscious of them, and that they were fundamental to having a good relationship on both sides of the Taiwan Strait. So with these in mind, let me make just a few points about Taiwan defense policy. Frankly, it's a little difficult to say where the Trump administration is going to go yet because the key players aren't in place. Assistant Secretary of State for Defense, I can tell you, is an incredibly important player when it comes to making decisions on Taiwan, and similarly, the Assistant Secretary of State. Neither of those two positions have been announced yet. But as we think ahead to the administration, I would just say a few things. The next speaker is going to talk in detail about China's military buildup. I would only say a couple of quick things. I see no reason for the administration to pull back from selling defensive arms to Taiwan or assisting Taiwan on indigenous capabilities. I think the Chinese assertive behavior in the East China Sea and the South China Sea should put the U.S. on notice that Beijing is starting to flex its muscles in the region, that it has abandoned the hide and bide policy. And I think Defense Secretary Mattis the other day warned very well on Capitol Hill when he said China is, quote, shredding trust in the region with its maritime assertiveness. My own view is that we need to concentrate assistance on credible homeland defense for Taiwan, using asymmetrical capabilities to help the people of Taiwan withstand any initial cyber, air, and missile attacks. I think that what Taiwan needs to concentrate on is jointness of forces. If there's any document that I think is one of the most beautifully written documents, if it can be said, of a DOD, it is JP1, the U.S. Doctrine of Jointness. The synergies that you can develop between forces today in space, in cyber, with your services is truly magnificent. And if we can teach Taiwan how to do this and do it well, and they can train to do it well, they will have a credible defense capability. As a former CIA officer, I will also tell you that there is another element of this that I think we haven't spent enough time on, and that is the invisible conflict of subversion. Taiwan needs a whole-of-society approach to defense so that Beijing knows that if their forces try to invade, they will face an insurmountable task in subduing the Taiwan people. Obviously, a key aspect of what I'm talking about is cyberspace, Taiwan's been slow to create the kind of cyber command needed against China's formidable capabilities. And we in the United States are very well aware of China's formidable capabilities in cyberspace. I'm glad that the Ministry of Defense in Taiwan has set up or plans to set up a unit later this year, but I think this needs to be a very high priority in the Taiwan defense budget. Taiwan also needs to study the concepts of whole-of-society defense that are being developed by countries like Poland, Finland, Latvia, and Lithuania in the wake of Russian operations in Ukraine. Believe me, the Chinese are studying what the Russians are doing, and they may have their own little green men strategy at some point for Taiwan, and we need to take it seriously. This is a new aspect of warfare that hasn't been studied very well. There are, though, many U.S. experts in this area. One expert who I talked to before this was a colleague of mine at Georgetown University in Special Operation Forces, and he says that there are many ways we can help Taiwan to develop a much better capability in the area. So to sum up my quick remarks here, Taiwan is up against a formidable task. The key is the will of the Taiwan people to resist with U.S. assistance. I think others will speak to the fact that none of this can be accomplished on the cheap. The people of Taiwan must fully understand that freedom is not free, as we know in the United States, and that in order to have these capabilities, they're going to have to spend more on defense. Thanks.
Well, a very good afternoon to you all, and thank you to Seth Kropsi for the invitation. It is a tremendous pleasure, a privilege to be here, and great fun, in particular to be on this panel, on this topic at this time. In many ways, the United States appears to be at a turning point in its policy towards Asia and towards China and towards Taiwan in particular. So many of the ways that we have been doing things for years, if not decades, may change. And the way our policy and our strategy looks a year from now, or 2 or 3 years from now, may be very different than the way it has looked in previous years. And so I think this is a very important topic at a very important time. And I thought I might just direct my brief remarks to two points. The first is the security situation in the Taiwan Strait, and the second is what the new Trump administration may or may not do to adjust to the reality. So on the first point, we have seen a remarkable deterioration in the relationship between China and Taiwan over the past year. Absolutely remarkable. And what's so remarkable about it is that Taiwan's new DPP government and President Tsai Ing-wen have been so pragmatic and so cautious and have really made multiple attempts across the spectrum to meet China halfway, actually to meet China more than halfway. And despite that, Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party have rejected her attempts wholesale and have really ratcheted up tensions. Now, we saw this before with the KMT government under President Ma Ying-jeou, where Taiwan's government tried to do everything in its considerable power to accommodate China. The previous KMT government, by the end of its 8 years in office, was almost obsequious towards Beijing. And it seemed to be the case that the more Taiwan tried to make peace, the more the Chinese tried to make trouble. This has not always been the case. This was certainly not the case when Hu Jintao was chairman of the Central Military Commission and the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. The trouble really began in earnest in 2013 when Xi Jinping began to consolidate his power. That is when the tone and the tenor and the dynamic really significantly changed. It was that summer that we saw the Mission Action series of military exercises where the PLA was actually simulating an all-out invasion campaign against Taiwan. This despite Taiwan's policies, despite the detente that had been agreed upon, despite the historic trade ties that had been developed, and despite the fact that the president of Taiwan at that time had embraced his own version of the One China principle. And things only deteriorated from that point. We saw the declaration of the ADIS. We saw the M503 flight line. We saw a series of very provocative military exercises directed against Taiwan, a series of very provocative studies that came out of the Chinese military, the PLA, directed at the invasion and occupation of Taiwan. The entire tone changed with Xi Jinping. And we've seen the same thing happen not just against Taiwan, but against Japan, against South Korea most recently, against the Philippines, of course against the United States. China has become a much more hawkish, much more aggressive, and much less rational international actor under Xi Jinping. And so I think there's very little reason for us to be optimistic that Taipei and Beijing could come to some framework or some agreement for sustaining the status quo. Not because it's not what Taiwan wants. I think the government in Taipei desperately wants to be able to maintain the status quo and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. But that's not what Xi Jinping wants. So I'm not saying that's not what China wants, because he does not represent the will, of course, of the Chinese people. He's just the leader of the Chinese Communist Party and the military. But that's what he wants. And I think it's very difficult if you look at his track record, his spoken statements, his military visits, all the activities that have transpired under his leadership. It's very difficult to make the argument that Xi Jinping wants peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait, that he wants to maintain the status quo. Clearly, he does not. Clearly, his plan is to piece by piece, step by step, to dismantle Taiwan's democracy, to subvert Taiwan, to change Taiwan, and ultimately to annex it or to conquer it, and to bring on an oppressive and alien form of government over the Taiwanese people, a form of government that nobody in Taipei, nobody in the government, nobody in the military, and nobody, none of the citizens, none of Taiwan's 23 million citizens could ever accept. And so the Taiwan Strait flashpoint is back and is growing more dangerous. And it's likely to grow far more dangerous in the years ahead. In this environment, I think the solution, to the extent that there is any solution to this kind of problem, I think the response that we take in Washington and the response that Taiwan is starting to take, and rightfully so, is to prepare for the worst-case scenario, is to start to invest more into hard power, to invest more into the types of capabilities that would deter, hopefully, Chinese aggression, and if necessary, in that nightmare scenario, defeat Chinese aggression. And so in that regard, I think there is reason for cautious optimism with the new Trump administration. It's too early to say, of course, but the initial sense, I think, that we're getting is that the new administration wants to invest much more into our military, to rebuild our military, and in particular, to focus and prioritize the types of capabilities that would be the most important for the defensive time. Capabilities like new stealth fighter, more stealth fighters. Capabilities like more Virginia-class attack submarines, capabilities like more Aegis destroyers, to improve our ability to fight in cyberspace and in outer space and across the electromagnetic spectrum, to improve our missile defense capabilities. These are all the tools that the United States must have at its disposal if it's ever called upon to come to Taiwan's defense. And these are all the tools that in peacetime, if successful, will hopefully deter conflict and prevent conflict from happening in the first place. And so in that regard, I think there's reason for some optimism, just based upon what we've heard so far and the priorities that the new administration seem to be bringing in office with them. But of course, As Mr. Wilder said, it really is too early to say. But the actions taken by the Pentagon by themselves will not be enough. We also need to do much more with Taiwan to have a much more forward-leaning and a much more open-minded policy on arms sales towards Taiwan. Taiwan needs the United States to assist it to develop certain components for its indigenous defense submarine program. That is something clearly that would be in our national interest to support, because submarines have such a powerful strategic effect. Now, we can debate the tactical utility of submarines based on the scenario, but at the strategic level, nothing would deter the Chinese in the same way that submarines do. And they've proven this fact by spending the last two decades going from city to city to city around the world to forbid governments and industries and doing everything in their considerable power to try to make sure that Taiwan does not develop a new submarine program. Because Taiwan already has four submarines, two of which are modern. And those submarines clearly calculate negatively into China's war plan for the invasion of Taiwan. But beyond submarines, Taiwan also needs to recapitalize its air fleet. Taiwan needs new fighter aircraft, whether that comes in the form of F-16s or F-35s. Clearly, the future is F-35. Taiwan needs new fighter jets. Its current inventory is aging, and they're becoming, in some cases, dangerous to fly because there's so many hours on those airframes. But the Taiwanese continue to fly them because they have no choice and because maintaining their air defense identification zone really matters. Because fighter aircraft are not just for wartime, they're also for peacetime, especially when the Chinese are flying bombers around the country, and they're sending aircraft carrier groups around the country. Taiwan also needs the next generation missile defense capability. And I think there's a debate what would be the most suitable for Taiwan, and ultimately only Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense can settle that debate. What makes the most sense for them, whether it's THAAD or Aegis Ashore, or something indigenous, that's not really a question for the United States. The question for the United States is, are we or are we not going to begin making defense articles and services available to Taiwan in a reliable and regular fashion? Are we going to continue to bundle arms sales notifications the way we did under the Obama administration? Because that was a disaster. That played havoc with Taiwan's ability to formulate a credible self-defense strategy. And it played havoc also with the credibility, the prestige and the credibility of the United States as a country willing to stand up to Chinese pressure and meet its commitments. Three arms sales packages in 8 years is shameful. No matter how big the price tags were, it needs to be very regular and very routine to have the effect of showing our commitment to the Taiwan Relations Act and the six assurances. Arms sales alone and a military buildup at home alone will also not be enough. It's not sufficient because the threat is so stressful. Taiwan faces a threat environment unlike any other democracy or any other ally in the world. China's massive military buildup, its rapid buildup of armaments capabilities in recent years, is really putting Taiwan in a difficult place, especially when you combine that with a reluctance here in the United States to make arms sales in a regular, or arms sales notifications in a regular fashion. We also need to begin inviting the Taiwanese Navy to RIMPAC, the Rim of the Pacific Naval Exercises in Honolulu, and to invite the Taiwanese Air Force to Red Flag in Nevada, to invite the Army to Fort Irwin in the National Training Center in California, to invite the Marine Corps to 29 Palms in California so they can have access to world-class urban warfare training environments, which they so desperately need. There are so many tools at our disposal for helping Taiwan have a credible self-defense capability. There are so many initiatives that are waiting to be pushed forward. It only takes political courage and political wisdom, and hopefully we'll get that in Washington. Now, there's no guarantees. It still is too early to say, but hopefully we'll start to see some of this out-of-the-box type thinking as we go forward So there's a lot of work to be done in Washington. There's a lot of work to be done in Taipei. And then, of course, there's a lot of work to be done across the region, in Tokyo and Seoul, across the region, for the democracies of Asia and of the Pacific to stand shoulder to shoulder to make sure that the American-led international order, rules-based order that respects rule of law and human rights and universal values, to make sure that this is not subverted and broken, and to make sure that our relationships, which we've forged over decades, in some cases forged with blood with our allies, to make sure that these are not split apart, because that's exactly what Beijing is attempting to do at the current time. This is happening in South Korea most recently, but it's happening across the board. And so we need to make sure that does not happen with Taiwan, because the stakes for getting this wrong are so high. And so I will conclude with that thought and turn it on over to Mr. Schneider, who will give you a much more detailed appraisal of what we might do. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity to discuss this very timely question. As we have a change in administration, it is always an opportunity to review the ways in which we can do better in terms of both national security and regional security. And Taiwan and the U.S. have had a security relationship since 1954, after the takeover of China by the Communist Party in the late 40s in the Korean War. The U.S. decided that they needed a different kind of security relationship with allied and friendly countries in East Asia than they did in Europe. And so instead of a multinational security arrangement such as NATO or the later CETO in Southeast Asia, they focused on the so-called San Francisco plan of a spoke-and-hub kind of thing, where the United States would have a sequence of bilateral security relations with the countries in East Asia. And the bilateral Sino-American Treaty of 1954, which survived until 1959, was the bedrock of our security relationship with China. And after normalization, as was discussed, both the U.S. and China needed a way to manage the question of relationships with Taiwan that would retain the peace and stability in the region. And I think in that respect, we have a framework that is a viable framework for maintaining the interests of all parties. That is to have a peaceful transition, if that's what the people of China and Taiwan want, and to have it worked out by them over time. We also want to find a way to assure that there are no incentives for the use of coercion or the use of force to change the situation in Taiwan. And between the three communiques, the six assurances, and the Taiwan Relations Act, I think we have a viable framework for dealing with this. And In the 1980s, deep in the 20th century, when I served in the Department of State, I had some responsibility for the execution of these three elements of our security relationship with Taiwan and the PRC, the TRA, the six assurances, and the three communiques. And I think if those are executed as intended, they can serve as a viable legal and policy infrastructure for peace in the region. But I think one of the things that has happened, and our other speakers have referred to it, there have been developments in the region that are placing great stress on the effectiveness of this relationship. And part of the situation in which the United States can have a constructive influence is its responsibilities for arms transfers. The rise of China has been extraordinary, both in economic and military terms, and it is certainly the dominant military power in the region. But the way in which China has evolved has placed extraordinary stress on the arms transfer practices developed in, for the under the Taiwan Relations Act. The underlying concept was that Taiwan should have a, as stated in the act, a self-sufficient self-defense capability. And in the implementation of that, remember, starting in 1979, it was only 3 years after the death of Mao, the Chinese had no significant capability for expeditionary operations at that point. And so we were dealing with relatively modest requirements that Taiwan would have to be able to assure that it, it could not be coerced into a relationship with the mainland that it did not freely choose. The focus was on assuring that, that China had an adequate, sorry, that Taiwan had an adequate capability in land, sea, and air forces to be able to deal with the threat posed. And modest arms supply relationship we had at the time was adequate. And during the course of the 1980s, there were some incremental improvements in those capabilities. But over the past decade, China has apparently had less patience with the legal and policy infrastructure we've had, and have increased the threat to Taiwan. This is perhaps started after the missile firing incident in 1996, when Taiwan's vulnerability to cruise and ballistic missile attack was made very apparent. But perhaps less subtly was the vast asymmetry in undersea capabilities. While Taiwan had a few submarines, two of which were purchased from the Netherlands in the mid 80s, but the procurement was interdicted for political reasons. As a result, Taiwan was left with a very small undersea capability at a time when there was a very substantial technology transfer from Russia to China in the development of advanced diesel electric and more recently air independent propulsion systems for submarines for China. In addition, again through technology transfer from Russia, the modern air defense, the HQ-9, for example, has made it unlikely that third or fourth generation tactical aircraft can survive in that environment. More recently, the deployment of the DF-16, which had previously been deployed in central China in relatively small numbers in Anhui province, has now been moved to coastal areas in very large quantities, perhaps of as many as 1,500 missiles. These are on five-axle transporter erector launchers, so they can't be readily pre-targeted, and they have a range of 800 to 1,000 kilometers and very high accuracy. We don't know too much about the payload of these systems, but even assuming it, these are all conventional weapons, that poses an extraordinary threat. Because of the nature of the new system, the DF-16, its very high trajectory means that its closing velocity is very high and could not be intercepted by the Patriot missiles, at least the ones that that Taiwan has. So with this kind of threat picture in mind, I think it's time to revisit the both the content and technology behind our arms transfer policy, because one of the pervasive trends that's that began in the 1980s, but now has gone throughout the defense establishment, is the impact of the technologies of information and its military applications on the capacity of small nations to have a rather effective defense. And just in looking at some of the different domains of warfare, where the issue of the submarine, of course, has been a prominent one for many years. The U.S. approved the sale of a submarine, if we could find one, in 2001. But the because the U.S. does not produce submarines, or at least produce conventionally powered submarines, the only alternative at the time was the use of an older U.S. diesel-electric design and modernizing it. But because of the way the foreign military sales system works, where the U.S. government takes on the obligation of assuring that the product will work and will assure a lifetime system of support, it was very expensive. And as a result, Taiwan did not move ahead with that particular system. But now it's going to undertake an indigenous program development. That will take some time. But in the meantime, things are happening with this application of the technologies of information, and that can offer some both a bridge to the time when Taiwan has submarines, but also reflecting a sort of teaming of manned and unmanned systems, which is, for those of you who've had an opportunity to witness how the U.S. is doing these things, that is becoming a very compelling suite of technologies that are producing new capabilities that are, and new concepts of operation that are in turn creating wholly new ways of conducting national defense. In the case of undersea warfare, where, as I said, our policies with respect to arms transfers was to assure that Taiwan could engage the threats in the domain of a self-sufficient self-defense in land, sea, air, undersea, and so forth. Development of unmanned systems for undersea warfare is proceeding very rapidly, in part because many of these platforms are already in use in civil applications for oceanography and bathymetric research and so forth that enable there to be a commercial market for these unmanned platforms. These unmanned platforms can carry sensors, and the seabed can be instrumented so that through the use of unmanned systems, the situation with respect to both undersea vehicles and surface ships can be much better understood than conventional technology, and can cover a much larger area. So having a networked undersea sensor capabilities then can be augmented by existing weapon systems or, as they come online, manned submarines as well. Another application of modern information technologies involves the technologies of autonomy, artificial intelligence, man-machine interface, and so forth. These technologies will enable small countries to operate much larger forces, because the much more effective forces as well, because the technologies of autonomy permit the autonomous operation of sensors and weapon systems. So these technologies are moving very rapidly. They're not dependent on military innovation in the sense that Toyota is probably going to do more to move the technologies of autonomy quickly than anything that's done by the Department of Defense. But these technologies will be picked up by the Department of Defense, and they are being involved. Not far behind are the technologies of directed energy. When combined with autonomy, can produce very effective air and missile defenses. These technologies in this application are not yet mature, but there's a great deal of innovation going into these areas. So I think the underlying point is that it's possible to be optimistic both from the perspective of technology and the perspective of affordability to be able to improve Taiwan's capability to maintain a self-sufficient self-defense that will not enable it to conquer the mainland China, but will enable the U.S. to support Taiwan within the terms of the Taiwan Relations Act, the three communiques, and the six assurances that will enable it to achieve that outcome. It requires some change in thinking in the sense that even though Taiwan has a very sophisticated scientific and industrial economy, its defense establishment has focused on technologies that are largely incremental improvements of systems that were fielded in the 1970s and 80s. And it now needs to think in a modern fashion about using modern technology that is going to be used by armed forces everywhere, including China, to create the conditions that will enable a peaceful evolution of relations between Taiwan and the mainland, so that the aims of this infrastructure of policy and diplomatic and legal arrangements that have served our interests for nearly 40 years can continue. So thank you. We'd be glad to answer questions.
I'd like to thank all three of our speakers for their presentations, but I'll do that more formally at the end of our discussion this afternoon. It's time for questions and maybe answers. When you are recognized, would you please tell us your name and the organization you're affiliated with, and to whom your question, in the form of a question, is addressed. Front row here will start first.
Thank you. John San with CTI TV of Taiwan. Taiwan has just officially launched its indigenous submarine program. Since the U.S. is not doing diesel-electric submarines anymore, in what concrete ways can the United States help Taiwan in this regard? Will the United States be able to overcome whatever Chinese opposition to this? As a quick follow-up, will the Trump-Xi summit have any impact on U.S.-Taiwan relations, including security relations? Thank you. The questions are addressed to all panelists. Thank you.
Well, I at least talk about the submarine. The U.S. actually has an industry that supports submarines, both conventional and nuclear. For example, Australia was having difficulty with its conventional so-called Collins-class submarines, and the U.S. firm General Dynamics worked with Australia to help resolve the problems in that submarine. So the industrial base and scientific base is there to do it. One should not underestimate the formidable task of developing a submarine from scratch. It's and hence my interest in finding some other things that will help Taiwan until they are able to actually build a submarine. And so the emphasis on using some of the new technologies, I think, might be usefully considered as part of a whole undersea system of which a manned submarine is one part.
Well, as to the question of will the forthcoming meeting between President Trump and General Secretary Xi Jinping, will that affect our approach to Taiwan or arms sales to Taiwan? I'm skeptical that it will. I very much doubt that it will have any impact. The only impact that I could envision would be that it might delay, because I would not anticipate the White House to announce a new arms sale in the next week or two before the visit or during the visit. So we might have to wait a few more weeks than we would otherwise for an arms sales notification to Congress. But other than that, I'm quite optimistic that this meeting will not have significant effects on our relationship with Taiwan, the type of which people have been worried about. I know in recent weeks, I was in Taipei last week, and there was an odd sense of pessimism on one side, depending on who you talk to, and then a wild optimism on the other side, depending on who you talk to. I'm more in the optimistic camp.
I am not as sanguine about this summit as my colleague, and I'll tell you why. I have worked on summits before. I have done all of the paperwork. I've been in the deputies and principals processes. I'm a little worried that we are rushing into this summit on the U.S. side. I mean, it's supposedly, if the dates that we hear are correct, in early April. The Chinese side, to me, is much more prepared for this meeting than the American side. After all, as I said before, many of the key positions aren't even filled within the administration. And I was a little bit disquieted by the way that Secretary Tillerson in Beijing used Chinese terms. I'm not sure he was fully appreciating what those terms meant. But certainly, I do not think the Trump administration should be supporting the new great power relationship that President Xi Jinping has talked about. That is not in the American interest. First of all, there are others in East Asia who are great powers. There are not two great powers in East Asia from our point of view. And so I'm a bit worried. And I would caution the administration to be very careful. The Chinese know this record very well, and they can turn your words against you. And so I think we need to be careful. I would hope that there's nothing done, frankly, at the summit on the Taiwan question. I hope that this summit deals with economic issues, building relationship, but doesn't actually, I would prefer that this issue wait a while until the administration really has had time to think about where it's going on the issues.
Yeah, and on the submarine question, I'm not, the fact that the United States hasn't built a diesel electric submarine for 40 years or so is, it is relevant, it's important, but there are some things that the United States defense industrial base does that are directly applicable, even though we haven't built SSKs for a long time. For example, turning the metal that the hull is made out of. That applies as much to nuclear boats as it does to diesel boats. Combat systems integration, that also has applications to a diesel electric submarine. So just to reiterate, the fact that we haven't produced one doesn't mean that we can't be very useful. So, the next question. Let's go to the back of the room here. Yes, I see it.
Russell Hsiao with the Global Taiwan Institute. excellent presentations. My question has to do with hoping you guys can think a little bit more long term. I know there's a lot of near term things that we have to resolve before in the immediate. But there's some prominent American strategists have suggested that in order to reach a new modus vivendi with China, that the United States should consider even rescinding the six assurances. Do you, this question is for all the panelists, but do you agree with such an assessment? And B, what does the six assurances achieve that the TRA alone cannot? So maybe perhaps leave that to the panelists to discuss.
Well, just a few things from my own recollection. When the three communiques were signed, the PRC negotiators pressed us for decisions in each one of those areas that's now become one of the six assurances. And President Reagan at the time did not want to allow the signing of the joint communique in 1982 to lead to a belief that it would affect the obligations under the TRA for arms transfers. And I think that it's unlikely that the U.S. would change the basis under the TRA, because it is a statutory obligation of the administration, and I doubt the Congress would agree to a change in that that statute. So it's probably more constructive to look at the communique, the six assurances, and the TRA as a policy and legal structure that has established the way our three entities can deal with this problem until the people in China and Taiwan find a way to deal with their ultimate political relationship.
I would just
go ahead.
The six assurances are bedrock. They are the guidelines. In addition to the law of the land, the Taiwan Relations Act, the six assurances are the guidelines. And what makes them so important is the assurance that the United States will not change its position on Taiwan's sovereign status. Now, what does that mean? It means that we do not view Taiwan as part of the PRC's sovereign territory. And Taiwan's international status is a matter that is not decided, and it's to be decided at some point in the future, potentially in the distant future, when the threat of Chinese attack on Taiwan, potentially on U.S. forces in Asia, has been removed, when that goes away. But the six assurances by themselves are necessary, but they're not sufficient. I think we need to be thinking about more assurances to Taiwan. We need to be thinking about perhaps a joint communique with Taiwan. Our policy towards Taiwan as it stands today is insufficient. It's old. It's outdated. The last time we thought seriously about it was in 1992, 1993, 1994. Taiwan since that time has become a dynamic democracy. It's become a beacon of freedom in Asia. The entire situation with Taiwan and with China and with the United States has changed. And so it makes sense for us to evolve our policy as that situation changes. And as Xi Jinping and the PRC put the squeeze on Taiwan, it becomes even more important as the Chinese ratchet up the tensions that we find ways to work with the Taiwanese to ratchet the tensions back down. And I think that's why we need to be thinking much more creatively, not just about the past, but about the future and what we want to do in the future with Taiwan.
Thank you very much. Sorry. Thank you very much. Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency of Hong Kong. And I have a follow-up question on the summit. Yesterday, Michael Green, who is just coming back from a visit to China last week, said that he believed the Taiwan issue will be the number one point that Xi Jinping will push on during the summit. And also, it was reported by the media that
Trump's administration will announce a new package of arms sales to Taiwan right after the summit. So my question is, how next summit will affect the arms sales to Taiwan, or put in another words, how the arms sales to Taiwan will affect the summit's result? Because I believe Trump would like to build a good relationship with Xi Jinping, but will it be a, you know, kind of negative effect on their, you know, the result of this summit? Thank you.
Well, my view is that this summit should be about one or two key issues. The first one has to be North Korea. We are in an incredibly dangerous situation on the North Korean issue. The North Koreans are moving toward having nuclear-tipped missiles capable of striking the continental United States. Experts disagree, but it could be 3 years, it could be 4 years, it could be 5 years, but there's no question that they're making progress in this direction. China has to get serious about this problem. Earlier this year, China talked about coal and cutting off coal, and there were big headlines. I am now talking to experts who question whether that decision really had much validity, since the point was that they were actually, in the first 2 months of this year, reaching the limit in dollar amount that they could buy from North Korea under their agreements to UN sanctions, because anthrax coal in China has gone up in price, and so volume versus price, they were already at their limits. If that's the case, then China didn't get serious with the coal ban. President Trump needs to be very clear with Xi Jinping that China has got to get serious about this problem, or, as Secretary Tillerson said in Korea, all options are on the table. China needs to take ownership of this issue. Another of my colleagues, you mentioned Mike Green, but Victor Cha, has made the point that I think is a very good one, that if China wants us to go back to the table, this time they pay for anything the North Koreans want. In all the other negotiations, what happened? The United States was left to pay for either light water reactors or coal or fuel for the North Koreans. No. This time, China needs to have skin in the game. So if Wang Yi wants us to go back to the table, great. But what's China going to put on the table? How is China going to guarantee this time that the North Koreans behave correctly and live up to their agreements? Because every time we've had an agreement with the North Koreans, they violated it. So that's a long-winded answer but I think this is the key question of the summit. I think if Xi Jinping wants to discuss Taiwan, President Trump ought to say, fine. When I come to Beijing, we'll have a discussion of Taiwan, but right now the issue is North Korea.
I have a slightly different view. I think it would be good for President Trump to engage Chairman Xi in a discussion on Taiwan. This would be a fantastic opportunity for a president of the United States to do something that our president has not done for far too long, and that is to stand up to the leader of China and to demarsh him to his face and to say his buildup of offensive destabilizing ballistic missiles across from Taiwan is unacceptable. That has not happened in a long time. China has drastically ramped up its deployment of missile systems across from Taiwan. These are missiles that the United States and the Soviet Union and then the Russian Federation outlawed. We outlawed, and we continue to outlaw per the INF Treaty because they are so dangerous and so destabilizing, and yet the United States government has said nothing, nothing. Now is a great opportunity for the president to do that. And if he wants to go even farther, to reiterate our commitment to Taiwan's defense and security at a time when the Chinese are ratcheting up the pressure on Taiwan and trying to further limit Taiwan's international space. I think they should have that discussion and make sure that the United States comes on strong right out of the gates, that we don't hide from this issue any longer. Obama tried to hide. The latter half of the Bush administration tried to hide from this issue.
Now, wait a minute. Do not go there. This is ridiculous. We didn't hide in the Bush administration from this issue. And I think you need to talk to the government of Taiwan and ask them their opinion of what you want him to say before you say that he should come on with a policy that is that provocative with Beijing.
I don't see how that's provocative at all. To demarche China for deploying offensive missiles, to demarche China for threatening Taiwan at a time when Taiwan's government is under such extreme threat, it would be spineless to do otherwise, in my view. And I don't think this president
is spineless.
Terms
like spineless and terms like capitulation to Beijing that you're suggesting that other administrations have done, I think, are irresponsible terms in this situation. We have a way to go forward on this issue, and we need to protect the people of Taiwan. We do not need to create a situation in which they are put at risk because we want to look tough.
Well, it wouldn't be posturing if it's private.
Oh, I don't think you could keep something like that private.
Well, then that would be a leak worth having.
Look, I since it's clear to me that our two panelists are so so close to agreement at this point, I'd like to ask Bill Snyder.
Yeah, so just a couple of points on it. I think the top leadership of two major states tend not to to try to find opportunities to have a confrontational meeting at the outset. And I think it's unlikely, even though both sides will are likely to present a mature and coherent position of their national interests, the idea that either are likely to break up a first meeting with this kind of confrontational rhetoric, I think is unlikely. It's just not the way these things work out. But I think both sides will probably have to call attention to their respective concerns. There was an article this week in the South China Morning Post about one of the advisors to the State Council, I believe, on Taiwan, saying that there was pressure now for China simply to, quote, absorb Taiwan into China, which suggested doing so by force. And it's sort of additive to all of these other incidents we've had that are I think the U.S. side would not see as helpful. And I suspect the parties will ventilate some of these, but I don't see the meeting as an opportunity for either side to make the next meeting difficult to schedule. They're going to be meeting often. President Trump has expressed a view that he's going to be president for 8 years, and if that's the case, we'll have plenty of opportunities to vent. But I don't think either side has an interest in a destructive relationship from the outset.
Question in the back.
China Times, Jeanette Jiang, China Times. Ian, you mentioned that Americans should invite Taiwan to join the RIMPAC, the Ring of Pacific exercise. I just want to ask the panelists' opinion on this, because it's not only involved in America or Taiwan or China, actually. In that area, there's a lot of other country actually involved in this exercise. So how the possibility would be in practice? Thank you.
Well, of course, China has generally objected to the presence of Taiwan, whether it's at the National Defense University or any place else where China is going to be involved, and I suspect that that practice would continue, but it's the RIMPAC exercise is maybe just one of many opportunities that have been denied Taiwan that has reduced the quality of their professional education and training. And I think even if for whatever political or diplomatic reason is chosen with respect to RIMPAC, I think the underlying thing is that a dimension that has been neglected in the arms transfer process has been training and professional military education, and I think that is a shared interest that that we should act on, and I hope the new administration will so decide.
I would just point out that the maritime domain in the Western Pacific is getting very, very complex. I think many of the navies of Asia and of the world would really appreciate the United States to provide the cover that they need to have the opportunity to interact with the ROC Navy in Hawaii in that kind of international forum, because otherwise they would not have that opportunity. And there will be instances in the coming years where these ships are passing each other in the South China Sea or in the East China Sea or in the Western Pacific. And this is a fantastic opportunity for these navies to get to know each other, to develop those type of patterns of cooperation that are so greatly needed given China's provocations along its entire maritime periphery. As for China's participation in RIMPAC, because of course that would be the issue, China has created a zero-sum game that it's either us or it's them. You can't have both at the same time. Clearly we should disinvite China from RIMPAC. If you talk to U.S. naval officers about the behavior of Chinese officers at RIMPAC, it is dishonorable. Some of the things that have gone on behind closed doors, the Chinese treatment of their hosts in Hawaii are very problematic and very unprofessional. And I don't think we should be rewarding bad Chinese behavior by inviting them to exercises, especially given everything that's going on in the South China Sea right now.
Right here, please.
Humphrey, I'm an intel analyst, and a former diplomat too, and I'm wondering if we've been serving as a mailbox for communications between Japanese intelligence and South Korean intelligence. And late last year, we finally shepherded a modus vivendi in which they can pass information to each other directly, saving time and hopefully giving us blind carbon copies on the way. But I kept feeling that this third member of the triad was missing. And I'm wondering if we can quietly encourage these two parties to extend the intelligence sharing agreements with Taiwan, and more importantly, network some of the weapon systems. For example, hydrophone networks are much more efficient when you're able to track, pass a signal from one part of the network to another without going through Uncle Sam to track a vehicle in real time. So that's I think, a huge force multiplier that we need to address. Is it possible, or are the Japanese and Koreans just going to be too afraid of China to do anything along those lines?
I think the inhibitions to such collaboration are probably diminishing as China is simultaneously increasing the threat to all three countries. And some of the new technologies that are coming along, the advanced fiber for having much higher data rate exchanges between sensors undersea and things of that sort would make this undersea network of sensors much more efficient and might reflect an opportunity to have the same kind of sharing of undersea data that we have to some degree with terrestrial and airborne information and space-based in some cases.
Yes, please, here.
everybody, for a really interesting panel. My name is Catherine Blakely. I'm from CSBA. Two questions on the Taiwanese side. We're expecting a white paper, I understand, imminently, with potentially a major increase in Taiwan's defense spending. What, if any, major shift should we expect to see in Taiwan's defense posture coming out of this white paper? Secondly, you alluded earlier, I think it was Ian, to issues of jointness in Taiwan's forces. I understand there's also significant recruiting and retention issues. So following on from this white paper, what is the appetite and the capability of implementing major shifts within the military forces and the Ministry of Defense of Taiwan?
Well, my understanding is that President Tsai herself has been talking to the defense ministry about being more forward-leaning, looking to the future a little more strongly, and I completely support that. I think that what was said earlier about looking at the future threats, instead of thinking about sort of what we need today, but thinking more out into the future of warfare is what I see, and I think Mr. Schneider was saying, was what Taiwan needs to see, that there are these autonomous vehicles. There is cyberspace. There is, this battlefield of the future is very different from the battlefield of past conflict. And Taiwan needs to come up to speed. One of the problems Taiwan has is they're cut off, frankly, from the world and from these ideas. One of the things we can do is to bring to Taiwan what we are learning about modern warfare and the capabilities that they need to add to their arsenal. And I think this is a really crucial issue, and I hope that whatever the Ministry of Defense in Taiwan does, they put more into cyber, they look at these new technologies, they look at autonomous vehicles and artificial intelligence. This is where warfare is going. And then the other issue I raised was the subversion of Taiwan, the clandestine capabilities China has, which I think Taiwan has got to take seriously as well.
So I would just point out that Taiwan has actually had a cyber command since 1999. They just didn't call it as such. If you look at the order of battle of the Taiwanese military, they have had a cyber command even before the United States did. And they are on the front lines, and they've long been on the front lines of the cyber battle with China.
Oh, I don't think so.
Taiwan is a test bed for a malicious code that the Chinese come up with. And if you talk to FireEye or many of the other cybersecurity companies that are U.S.-based, they rely very heavily on Taiwanese analysts for their abilities. I used to work at a software company in Taipei as a translator, and so I got to learn firsthand while I was there, some of the hacking capabilities that the Taiwanese have, because that was something some of my colleagues did for fun in their off hours, some of the programmers at the company. Taiwan does have some significant capabilities in this regard, and we would, all benefit, both of our countries would benefit from closer cooperation in this realm. As for the new QDR, Minister of National Defense Feng released, I believe, last Friday. He went before Taiwan's parliament and presented it. It's not available online yet, I don't think. It's certainly not available in English. It'll probably take a few more days for that to happen. But according to his testimony before the LY, one of the biggest changes to Taiwan's national strategy going forward is to focus more on a missile-centric defense. Because Taiwan has a layered defense. In the event of Chinese invasion, because it's the invasion scenario that drives Taiwan defense planning. If you're familiar with the Guam operational plan, which is Taiwan's plan to defend itself, this is the number one threat that Taiwan has faced since 1950, when the PLA first started planning for the invasion of Taiwan. And so they've had a long time to prepare. They've studied this to death. If you read MND's professional military literature, the journals that come out of the Army, the Reserve Command, even the engineers and the special operations, they all have their own professional technical journals. And it's just incredible some of the things that they've come up with, some of the very innovative systems that they've developed to defend against that threat. And a big part of that is developing cutting-edge cruise missile capabilities, anti-ship missile capabilities, air defense missile capabilities. Taiwan actually has a longer-range, faster anti-ship missile than the U.S. Navy does, which is remarkable. They have a very, reportedly, a very capable cruise missile program, and that has finally been confirmed. Of course, this is a program that goes back to the 90s, if not to the 1980s, but it's now officially, apparently, in the new QDR, something that is going to be publicly acknowledged in order to have that deterrent value. Because there are many capabilities that if you keep them secret indefinitely, they won't help you prevent war. And so sometimes it's valuable to bring out some of your capabilities, not all of them, of course, but some of them, to show the Chinese that if China does engage in massive cyber attacks on Taiwan or mass ballistic missile attacks on Taiwan's cities, that they'll pay a cost for that. That's what the name of the game is all about in terms of deterrence. And I think that's a very positive development that we're likely to see.
Rex?
Rex Weapon, Northern Resource. And this question is for Seth. Given that China is already militarizing the second island chain through the creation of islands in the South China Sea, what should be U.S. maritime posture in the region to counteract that, and what's probably the most realistic and greatest threat to Taiwan, which may not be a D-Day type invasion, but rather a blockade? Thank you.
The U.S. position, of course, is based on its appreciation of international law, that it has the right of passage for not only commerce but naval and air combatants through these international waters. The Chinese positions from a military perspective are very vulnerable. They that if there were a full-scale conflict, they would not be able to hold those positions. I think the experience of Imperial Japan showed that a tight grip on little islands is not a good a strategy. And so I think although the Chinese have militarized it, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration of projection of Chinese power. It's really to stabilize their diplomatic position, but everything we've heard so far from the administration is that they intend to retain the right of freedom of navigation and do not consider the South China Sea an inland sea as China has suggested, and seem likely to me to continue it and perhaps even have more forceful demonstrations of the freedom of navigation.
I would push back a little bit on the idea that the blockade is the most dangerous scenario facing Taiwan. A blockade is the most likely. It's the most likely, but it's not the most dangerous. A blockade would be very difficult for China to pull off over a long period of time. The type of timeline that would be required to have the coercive effect on Taiwan that Beijing would desire. Blockade is easier to do than invasion, of course. Invasion is almost impossible when you're faced with the type of layered defenses that Taiwan has already developed and continues to develop. No successful amphibious operation in human history has ever been carried out in the face of a robust defensive missile regime, a robust reconnaissance strike regime, the likes of which Taiwan has developed. And there are many other reasons why the invasion scenario is the least likely of all possible scenarios. But of course, it's the most dangerous, because this is the only scenario where China could actually conquer and occupy Taiwan, which of course is the CCP's ultimate objective. The blockade, you can ratchet up pressure on Taiwan, and you can force the Taiwanese to back away from some kind of constitutional revision or some kind of statement that the president may have made that offended the Chinese to an extreme degree. But a blockade could not force Taiwan to submit to occupation. That would take an invasion, and the invasion is much, much harder to pull off. So I think the blockade is likely, more likely, but certainly not as dangerous.
Rick Fisher, International Assessment and Strategy Center. Excellent panel all around. Thank you. When the Chinese also mention next generation technologies, the combining of artificial intelligence, weaponization of information spheres, they also include dominance of outer space. There are Chinese experts who've written books that try to round all these up as a fifth generation in the evolution of warfare. And we can see very clearly that they're working on all the pieces and are centralizing the development or the identification, development, and then projection of these future capabilities within their strategic support force. That is going to be the harbinger of their fifth generation of warfare as it develops into the next decade and into the 2030s. The aspect of cooperation with Taiwan that I'm interested in hearing some comment on, perhaps from Bill, others, is the degree to which we cooperate with Taiwan in terms of outer space. We launch satellites that the Taiwanese manufacture down in Hsinchu. But should we also be working with Taiwan and encouraging Taiwan to develop a wider space access capability, not only for commercial ventures, but as the South Koreans and the Japanese have been doing for a long time, to help to proliferate the ability of our allies to have access to space in ways that make it much more difficult for China to, in the future, establish control over low Earth orbit with all of the strategic and battle on Earth implications that that has. Thank you.
I think there are some good opportunities to deal with better security of space platforms. If you see what's happening in the commercial sphere, they're doing the opposite of what we've done in the military sphere, where we've made huge satellites that have extraordinary capability, but also have extraordinary vulnerabilities. Uber's concept of putting 4,000 small satellites up there for creating a network is not only a practical, but it's a much more constructive way to create a communications capability in space that has much more redundancy, much wider bandwidth, and generally a much better capacity to serve the needs of not only the country putting the payload in orbit, but it also can be run on both a shared commercial and defense utilization. So I think that as we were discussing earlier about the concept of absorbing more of the applications of the technologies of information, Taiwan is very well prepared for it. Some of that artificial intelligence work and so forth is also being done in Taiwan, and I think that Taiwan's defense sector needs to catch up to its commercial sector in terms of the absorption, application, and use and development of new concepts of operation that actually exploit this the opportunities that the technologies are creating.
I agree completely with that. I think that there are opportunities for Taiwan to engage in space, and these information technologies, as was said, many of them Taiwan industry is very good at. But I do disagree with my colleague that they're on the cutting edge in terms of cyber warfare. In a $10 billion defense budget, with all of the things they have to do, it's hard for me to believe that they can be on the cutting edge in cyber warfare.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question, and that will be overtime. So, here.
Faisal Faso, freelance writer. I wanted to comment on the Taiwan's role in the U.S.-China relationship, because we always see this, you know, the Chinese militarization is obviously alarming, but what kind of diplomatic role could Taiwan play to a more stable U.S.-China relationship where we can strategically cooperate? And that's it.
I think there's been some efforts to try and get Taiwan integrated into some international institutions, for example, that don't have the politico-military sensitivities that others might, where Taiwan and China both may have opportunities to contribute. So far, that hasn't been a very successful approach, because China's concerned about conferring any sort of political or diplomatic legitimacy on it, but perhaps there may be some new opportunities, and that would be, it seemed to me, would be a constructive path for the new administration to pursue in terms of trying to develop some of these opportunities that may have been offensive to China when it was smaller and weaker, but now may see as something that could be seen as a constructive diplomatic development.
I personally don't share the view that we should somehow use Taiwan as a chip or as an instrument to improve or advance our position or our relationship with the People's Republic of China. I think the U.S.-Taiwan relationship should be based and should be judged on its own merits because it's in the U.S. national interest. Taiwan is... And here I'm quoting our AIT director, Ken Moy, Taiwan is an example, one of the few examples that we have in Asia of what our vision for the future of the Asia Pacific looks like. Taiwan is a role model. It's a role model for countries across the region. And to the extent that Taiwan could play a role that would help us, and again, I'm not suggesting that that's how we should think about it, but Taiwan naturally plays a positive role vis-a-vis China, because the only way that we'll ever have a truly healthy relationship with China is when China has a democratic government. As long as China has a communist government, an authoritarian government, we will always be at odds with each other, and there will always be the potential for crisis or even conflict. And so Taiwan's example, its democratic example, it's the first Chinese-speaking country in history to become a successful democracy and to respect human rights and to embrace universal values. That is Taiwan's greatest contribution, not just to China, but to the entire region and also to the United States. It's a great success story, and we I think, are remiss to forget that.
I'm going to surprise everybody by agreeing on that question. I think that it is the wrong way to frame the issue to say somehow that Taiwan can help us resolve these problems. What we've said in our history is China and Taiwan must figure out their relationship. They must, if they're going to ever come to an understanding, it's got to be one that both sides agree to and no coercion. And let's let them figure this out. And we figure out our relationship with Taipei, and we figure out our relationship with Beijing, but we don't, you know, this is one of the key points in the Taiwan guidelines, the six assurances, that we're not going to force anybody to negotiate. We're not going to pre-notify our Taiwan arms sales to Beijing for their approval. These are very sensible ways of dealing with the issue, and I think we continue.
Well, Hanel, these are really excellent presentations, and I appreciate your joining us today and sharing your insights with the group. I'd like to thank all of you for coming out today as well. And hope that you will stay tuned to Hudson, Hudson site, because there will be more such discussions on this and related issues to the relationship between the United States and Taiwan in the coming months. Thank you very much.